Good morning, everyone. Our subject for the week, the doctrine of the atonement, the problem of sin, and its destruction. Source materials used for this week, Help Us Israel by Brother John Thomas, Doctrine of the Atonement by Brother J.J. Andrew, The Blood of the Covenant, Brother J.J. Andrew, Sin, Its Origin, Effects, and Destruction, Brother Arthur Andrew. And if you're not familiar with this work, it is out of the 1876 Christadelphian from the months of, I believe it's August, September, and also October, 1876. Probably one of the best considerations of the subject of sin itself that I think that we've got in writing. Sin, Its Origin, Effects, and Destruction, Brother Arthur Andrew. Three works by Brother Thomas Williams, Adamic Condemnation, Rectification, and Regeneration. The Way of the Tree of Life by Brother James Fair. The Place of the Abrahamic Covenant in the Salvation of Mankind, Ted Fair. And The Imputation of Adam's Sin, Brother Ted Fair. And there are, of course, other works and other references that we could make mention of, but those are the main things in which we resourced in preparing this class. Now, a few opening verses before we get into this. Let's start off in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 51 through 54. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 51 through 54. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, and please note, death is swallowed up in victory. Hebrews 9 and 28. Hebrews 9 and 28. So Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, and unto them that look for him shall he appear, the second time without sin unto salvation. Now take note of that phrase, the second time without sin unto salvation. There is a future aspect of this term to be saved or salvation. And later on in the week, we're going to talk about the past tense of the word saved, the present tense, as well as the future tense of this principle of salvation. And then 1 John chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. 1 John 3, verses 1 through 3. Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, that being Christ, we shall be like him. For we shall see him as he is. And every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself, even as he is pure. Revelation chapter 7, verses 9 through 17. And we're going to jump around a little bit in that section. Revelation chapter 7, verses 9 through 17. I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man can number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne, and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands, and cried with a loud voice, saying, salvation to our God which sitteth upon the throne, and unto the Lamb. And then down to verse 13. And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, what are these which are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? And I said unto him, Sir, thou knowest. And he said to me, These are they which came out of great tribulation, and have washed their robes, and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore are they before the throne of God, and serve him day and night in his temple, and he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of waters. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. And then Revelation 21, verses 3 and 4. Revelation 21, verses 3 and 4. In considering the Christ bride in the symbolic vision of the New Jerusalem, it states, And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them. And they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow, nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. Now, we put before you these wonderful Bible passages, and many others could be referenced, as an introduction to our consideration this week on the subject of the atonement. What do these verses have to do with the principle of atonement? What do these verses have to do with the principle of atonement? Everything. Everything, as they represent the great, desired, and promised end, as well as a new beginning of God's plan and purpose with this earth and mankind upon it. Now, in these sampling of verses we see, in a sampling of verses with a bigger context in mind, we see the certainty of resurrection for a specific class of people. We see the hope of eternal life to come and the sharing of the same perfect nature that Christ now possesses to an exclusive class of people. The end of death upon the earth, and therefore the end of sorrow that the existence has brought to man since the introduction of sin. God manifestation brought to its perfect and an all-encompassing realization when God is joined in quintessential unity with his creation of immortal beings who in the days of their mortality chose to serve God by free will rather than the impulses of their own desires. And we see the central role that Christ plays as the instrument of the Father in providing such salvation. We see the central role that Christ plays as the instrument of the Father in providing such salvation and such a glorious end, as well as a new beginning. Now, in considering the subject, in weighing out its mechanics, its definitions, its processes, and laws of doctrine, it is sometimes too easy for us to lose sight of the all-important end before us. The continued conflicts that have circulated around this glorious subject, not only in our Christadelphian history, but ever since the establishment of the first century ecclesia, have drawn the topic into a constant state of turmoil, which can make this subject seem more like a debate to be won or a territory of thought to be fiercely defended rather than a doctrine of extraordinary hope, comfort, and application. This is a doctrine of application. Now, make no mistake in our comments is that the mechanics, processes, definitions, and laws of what we are to consider this week are of the utmost importance and are to be promulgated and defended without compromise. And it is our intent, Lord willing, to consider these very details this week as they hold for us the only means of salvation. And in these details, we see the glorious, merciful, and ingenious, and we put special emphasis on ingenious, the ingenious handiwork of our all-wise Creator. But this doctrine means nothing without the end, the glorious objective in full view. What is the purpose? What is the ultimate purpose or principle of the atonement? But as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with what? The glory of the Lord. The atonement offers the only means by which God will be perfectly manifest in the midst of His glorious creation. The doctrine of the atonement puts before us the way of the tree of life. But as we all know, there is a seemingly impenetrable barrier to the achievement of an end that promises of resurrection, immortality, of eternal inheritance of the earth, of God dwelling in the midst of man. And that problem is the problem of sin. We read in 1 John chapter 3, if we could turn that up, please. 1 John chapter 3, verse 8. And we are going to take note of the second sentence of the verse. And this is the springboard for our entire week. 1 John chapter 3 verse 8, the second sentence of the verse. For this purpose, underline. For this purpose, the Son of God was manifested, that He might destroy the works of the devil, or diabolos. For this purpose, the Son of God was manifested, that He might destroy the works of the diabolos. Now, such a statement as this makes it clear, as seen from a comprehensive viewpoint, that this was the entirety of Jesus' mission. This was the entirety of Jesus' mission. Not only during His first appearance, but that which continues today and will continue on until the end of His 1,000 years reign. When speaking of the devil or diabolos, we are of course speaking of sin, which is that which is contrary to God's laws and His righteousness. And we're going to define that further as we get a little further in here. It is interwoven into the human experience, physically, morally, and even legally, as a matter of divine law, with manifestation in the political and religious realms as well, all due to the sin of Adam and Eve. And that which is the source of all evil, suffering, and death. It is not, the diabolos, is not supernatural, but very much of the flesh, and that of man's doing. The diabolos nature was not the cause of man's fall. Rather, through sin, man gave rise the diabolos nature. Let me repeat that. The diabolos nature was not the cause of man's fall. Rather, through sin, man gave rise to the diabolos nature. It was caused and continued by man, and can only be rectified by God's intervention. During Jesus' ministry on earth, he was constantly working to destroy the works of the devil, whether it be preaching the truth, the gospel, to turn men away from the errors of man's creation, or by curing the various diseases which were a result of sin. As is stated in Acts 10:38, healing all that were oppressed of the devil. In scriptural language, why did Jesus die the death of crucifixion? Hebrews 2:14. Turn that up real quickly, please. Hebrews 2:14. What was Christ to do with the death of the crucifixion? To destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil or the diabolus. What was the purpose of his resurrection? To deliver him from that which has the power of death. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin. But Christ destroyed the power of sin in himself through his death. Christ continues this effort in his mediatorial work that his brethren might receive the forgiveness of their sins, which are in fact the work of the diabolus. When he returns to this earth, his very first priority is to free his brethren from the power of the diabolus, to free them eternally from mortal flesh, from sin's flesh, the diabolus nature. We read in their next work, Christ joined with his faithful brethren in Psalm 149:7-8. And we'll come around to this verse towards the end of our lessons at the end of the week. Psalm 149:7-8, that along with the saints, the next work will be to subdue the political manifestation of sin found in the current powers of this world, to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. In apocalyptic symbolic terms, we read in Revelation 20:2 of what we've just read in Psalm 149. In Revelation 20:2, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil, and bound him 1,000 years. And even then the work is not yet finished in dealing with this problem of sin or the devil. A work that continues to the very end and into the dawn, into the 1,000-year reign and into the dawn of the 8th day. It is the primary objective of Christ during the millennial age to reign until he has put all enemies under his feet. And what is that last enemy? It is death. What brings forth death? Sin brings forth death. According to the 6th chapter of Romans, sin brings forth death. Sin is the root, and death is the consequence. And we read of the end of the 1,000 years in Revelation 20:10. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. In other words, the sin flesh influence that deceives men to rebel against God, and that which brings forth death, is swallowed up in utter and perpetual destruction. Therefore, it is made evident to us that the destruction of the diabolos, in other words, sin and its consequences, involves, and special emphasis on this, the whole work of Jesus Christ from beginning to end. Herein lies the subject before us in the matter of the atonement, the means by which a special class of individuals are provided rescue from the ultimate consequence of sin through the instrumentality of Christ, so that God may fulfill his purpose to fill the earth with his glory. In dealing with the grand subject before us, we must first give consideration to the origin and consequence of sin before we can fully address the means of its ultimate destruction. But before we even get to that, we wish to provide preliminary terms and definitions to hopefully, and we put emphasis on that term, hopefully, add clarity to our subject and remove any doubt as to the various terminology we will be using. Some are biblical words. Others are, in fact, biblical principles. But what we will consider in essence are the ingredients found in the doctrine of the atonement. And then we will spend the week demonstrating how these ingredients, the terminology, works together. Now, the handout that was passed out as we started this morning. Before we put up the definition up on the screen, I want you to think about each one of these in your mind before we jump into it. And again, these are terms that we know, that we understand how they're applied. But if asked to give a definition, at least that was my shortcoming, to ask to give a spot-on definition, I had to think about it. First one, law. What does law mean to us? What does law mean? A verse to consider is, before we even jump into the definition, is 1 Corinthians 14 and 33. That God is not, and the author is not in the original, God is not of confusion or instability or disorder. We might say that law is just the opposite of instability or disorder. From the American Heritage Dictionary, it is a rule of conduct or procedure established by custom, agreement, or authority. The Oxford Dictionary defines it as the system of rules which a particular country or community recognizes as regulating the actions of its members and which it may enforce by the imposition of penalties. For our purpose in this class, and what we believe to be a more biblical definition, it is the system of rules enacted by God upon man in accordance with his absolute sovereignty and supreme standard of righteousness. With the enacting of such law, God carries absolute prerogative in the imposition of penalties for disobedience to such law, as well as reward for obedience. There's a few words in the scriptures for law, but one is from a Hebrew word commonly interpreted as a statute or ordinance or that which is prescribed. Another word which we are probably familiar with is commonly translated from the Hebrew word Torah. This is law, direction, or instruction. For our purposes this week, the laws that we will, or the terminology that we will consider is Edenic law, the law of sin and death, the law of Moses, the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus, or simply the law of the Spirit of life. We also know that God has organized this universe with various what we might call natural laws. For those who are good at math, and I am not, but for those who are good at math, understand the governing of very specific laws, very specific and unmovable laws that govern the organization of everything around us, everything that we see in a natural sense. The next word, command or commanded, is from the Hebrew tsava. Pretty straightforward. To command, charge, give orders, lay charge, give charge to, order. Now, all the terms that follow after this, all the terminology has to do with the breaking of God's initial command to man, the Edenic law. And again, that leads to the terminology that will follow. Sin. The word sin. I know that all of us have an automatic reaction to that word. What comes up to our mind? Sin. It is from a Hebrew word, a root. To sin, miss the way. Often we hear the terminology to miss the mark. Go wrong, incur guilt, forfeit. It also, to miss, to sin, to miss the goal or path of right and duty, to incur guilt, incur penalty by sin, and again, forfeit. There are two applications to this in the scriptures. This is very important for us to have perfectly clear in our mind. There is moral application, that it would be something personally done by somebody, personal sin. It is the transgression of law. And there is the physical application of sin, what we call sin's flesh. And we're going to, I don't think there's any better definition than what Brother Thomas provides in Elpis Israel on page 129, if you have the Logos version. He says, the physical principle of the animal nature, which is the cause of all its diseases, death and resolution into dust. It is that in the flesh which has the power of death. And it is called sin, because the development or fixation of this evil in the flesh was the result of transgression. Inasmuch as this evil principle pervades every part of the flesh, the animal nature is styled sinful flesh, that is, flesh full of sin, so that sin, in the sacred style, came to stand for the substance called man. In human flesh dwells no good thing. And all the evil a man does is the result of this principle dwelling in him. This, right here, is sin's flesh. It is a physical principle. Transgression. It is from the Hebrew pesha. It means to revolt. It can be national. It can be moral. Or religious. It indicates rebellion, sin, trespass. Impute. What does the word impute mean? And the way that we reference it is in relation to both imputed sin and imputed righteousness. Impute. To relate to a particular cause or source. Place the fault or responsibility for. To bestow on something or somebody as due appropriate. The second is to assign as a characteristic. Credit. To assign value to. Sorry about the misprint there. Though no inherent value exists. And the example that we provide is actually from Brother Ted Fair, which we think is a very good way to address this word impute. He uses the example of paper money by governments. A dollar bill is a piece of paper measuring approximately 6 inches by 2.5 inches. The piece of paper has no intrinsic value of its own. But by a careful printing process, the government imputes value to the paper, even though it has no value of its own. Imputed sin, imputed righteousness. Keep those in mind. Condemnation is the action of condemning someone to a punishment or sentencing. And I missed that slide. That slide did not make it in there. This is the action of condemning someone to a punishment or sentencing. Two terms to consider here. Adamic condemnation. Though this full phrase does not appear in the scripture, the principle is clearly taught. It is the legal sentence to death, which manifests itself in the physical nature, that all inherit from Adam. Though not personally guilty of Adam's offense. Think back to our word impute. Though not personally guilty of Adam's offense. We'll consider more in the next few days this Romans 5 and 12. In Romans 5 and 16, and also Romans 8 and 1, it is from the Greek word katakrima. As used in Romans chapter 5, verses 16 and 18, it is an adverse, damnatory sentence. Krima is connected to the Hebrew idea of a legal relationship. Let me say that again. Krima is connected to the Hebrew idea of a legal relationship. A legal relationship. This connects directly with the use of the word imputation. And that though not personally guilty of the sin of Adam, the consequences or penalty of that action is imputed to all of his descendants as a matter of law. And then we also have moral condemnation. To be condemned and therefore punished based upon a personal action in disobedience or rebellion to a law or system of laws. Now justice, I'm not going to try to pronounce it as far as the Hebrew word, it indicates righteousness in a case or cause. Atonement. What does the word atonement mean? Be careful here. This is a critically important word to our subject this week, obviously, and it's an understatement too. It is from the Hebrew word, there's condemnation. That moved around on me. It is from the Hebrew word kafar, which means to cover. Biblically speaking, it is a covering for sin. The word itself in English actually speaks to the effect rather than the root action that is indicated in the original. If broken down into three parts, we have at 1 month. The English word indicates a position of reconciliation, a bringing together of two parties where a breach once existed. The English word is doctrinally appropriate, but cannot be understood without understanding the original meaning of covering. Such is the result of kafar, or a covering. The sin creating the breach must first be covered. Real quickly, let's take a look at Psalm 32 and 1, where this word kafar appears, and it actually is translated cover. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered, or kafar. Also Psalm 85 and 2. Thou hast forgiven the iniquity of thy people. Thou hast covered, or kafar, all their sin. Selah. And this all takes us back to that critical time and the contrast between the fig leaves in which Adam and Eve covered themselves versus the coats of skins that the Elohim provided for their covering. Next word, reconcile. Also from the Hebrew word kafar. Reconcile, also from the Hebrew word kafar. In the New Testament, it is apokatoluso. Brother Andrew, in his pamphlet, The Doctrine of the Atonement, defines it as to move or excite with a view to bringing together again. That implies that there has been a previous oneness, but that it has been severed. It implies a previous oneness that has been severed. Justify. Justify. In the Old Testament, it is from a Hebrew word that means to be made right or righteous. To be made right or righteous. We think of Melchizedek, which means king of righteousness, from that same root word. Isaiah 53 and 11 states of Christ's sacrificial work. shall my righteous servant justify many? In the New Testament, justify or justification is from a series of closely related Greek words that follow this same line. From Thayer we read, the act of God declaring men free from guilt and accepting or acceptable to him, adjuring to be righteous, or in other words, made righteous by law. Mercy, the word mercy. This means to show compassion, goodness, pity. In the New Testament, it indicates kindness. Webster's defines it as compassion or forbearance shown especially to an offender or to one subject to one's power. Sacrifice. From the primitive Hebrew root, zebach, it means to slaughter, kill, to slaughter in divine judgment. Let me repeat that. It means to slaughter, kill, to slaughter in divine judgment. Therefore, sacrifice requires the shedding of blood. It is death by premature and violent means. Covenant. A legal agreement, promise, or contract, either written or verbal between two or more parties, to do or not to do a certain act or work which is specified in the terms of the agreement. From the Hebrew word berit, meaning to cut, or to cut a sacrifice. And in the Greek, diatheke, an appointment. But unlike the pacts made between men, God's covenant, used interchangeably with the term law in the scriptures, does not depend upon man's acceptance and stands independent of man's consent or consultation. Let me repeat that. God's covenant does not depend upon man's acceptance and stands independent of man's consent or consultation. It is established and enforced by divine prerogative alone. This isn't two different parties coming together and negotiating out a contract, and if you give a little here, I'll give a little here, and we'll come to an agreement here. It is by divine prerogative alone. Let's go to Psalm 105, verses 8 through 11. He hath remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations, which covenant he made with Abraham, and his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant, or the covenant of the age, saying, unto thee will I give the land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance. Now we put up here, on two sides, we have the Old Covenant, or what in the Scriptures is referred to as the Old Covenant, that being the Mosaic Law. On the surface, a law given to the Israelites by God for them to serve and obey Him with the promise of long life in the land. And we're going to dig a little deeper on the Old Covenant apart from that, but that's where we're going to leave it for now. The New Covenant, on the other hand, and here we have some synonyms for that new covenant, or everlasting covenant, the covenant of the age, or covenant for the age, the Abrahamic covenant, the law of the Spirit of life, though promised first, ratified by Christ's shed blood at the end of the Mosaic, therefore putting an end to the old covenant. This gave the surety of resurrection, the hope of eternal life, and the means to inherit the promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Edenic covenant, or we might say the Edenic promise, and the Davidic covenant, the sure mercies of David, are connected to and bookend the Abrahamic covenant, with the first promising of the seed of the woman that would destroy the power of sin and death, and the latter providing a promised king through the line of David to rule over God's kingdom, the full and permanent restoration of the Israelites in their land as the central focus of the kingdom, and the certainty of David's own resurrection to witness this for himself. Now, I've already heard this term. Brother Jacob used this in his terminology in a Sunday school yesterday. Federal head or federal headship. The position that the male represents. The position, this was tough finding a definition for this. It's archaic terminology. The position that the male represents his descendants. Two such relationships, scripturally speaking, either under Adam or under Christ. No in between there, either Adam or Christ. Hence the term federal relationship or federal heads. Adam, by natural birth, and we'll get into this as we go through this week, by natural birth under condemnation to death, sin's flesh nature under the constitution of sin without hope. Christ, and we're going to actually expand that list later in the week, by baptism or covenant, freed from condemnation, under the constitution of righteousness, still sin's flesh nature, the promise of resurrection, the hope of life eternal, not possessed. The hope. We'll also dig into that more as well. The term alien or aliens means to estrange away, that is, passively and figuratively, to be a non-participant. It is from a root meaning to be off, that is, away from something near. There are two types of alienation that we will consider this week. Racial alienation, which is a position of estrangement or separation from God due to constitution or federal relationship by birth. Under the federal headship or relationship to Adam, constituted sinner due to relationship to Adam. This position leaves one estranged from the benefits and hope found under the law of the Spirit of life. And then there is moral alienation, a position of estrangement or separation from God due to one's own personal transgression, especially pertinent to those in Christ who follow after sin after baptism. Now, I jumped ahead just a little bit, but we also have, again, constitutions, two constitutions, the constitution of sin and the constitution of righteousness, the constitution of sin and the constitution of righteousness. And notice that our terminology and our negatives and positives are lined up with what we had under the heading of federal headship. The terminology substitute versus a representative. Substitute versus representative. A substitute, a person or thing that takes the place or function of another. A representative, one that serves as an example or type for others of the same classification. I like that. Serves an example or type for others of the same classification, and also one that serves as a delegate or agent for another. And to round out our terminology, our final terms, that which defines our relationship and status in regard to the atonement. First of all, provisional. Providing or serving for the time being only, existing only until permanently or properly replaced. temporary. Number two, probation. The status of a person being tested or on trial. A testing or trial as of a person's character, ability, etc. Third, legal. Conforming to the law. According to law. Moral. Concerning the principles of right and wrong behavior and the goodness or badness of human character. Involves the character. And finally, physical. Relating to the body as opposed to the mind. And that's where we'll stop with lesson one.